Chapter 12. The Boomers All Grown Up. The 1980s were now upon us, and we were no longer a country trying to figure out how to rally a population to win a war. We were now trying to figure out how to capitalize on the amazing boom years in which we were living, the roaring 80s. During this period, new economic theories were being proposed to protect the wealth the boomers were accumulating, a classic symptom of excess. Where the radio, automobile, and electric refrigerator were the must-have items of the 1920s, another new technology became all the rage in the 1980s. The IBM PC, MS-DOS, Apple's Macintosh, and Microsoft Windows all contributed to the rise and spread of the personal computer. A PC on every desk, as Bill Gates, the young founder of Microsoft, envisioned. We no longer needed to go to work to have power. We could have power alone at home, too. The individual could compete against the corporation. Even the new technologies of the day supported the desire for more individualism. We were also becoming more and more comfortable with products having shorter lifespans. Other inventions of the 1980s included the disposable camera and disposable contact lenses. Disposability, another symptom of our excess, was now an industry to be pioneered. We were actually looking for more things we could throw out. And there was one other thing we started to view as disposable. People. The day we embraced layoffs. August 5th, 1981. That's the date it became official. It's rare that we can point to an exact date when a business theory or idea becomes an accepted practice, but in the case of mass layoffs, we can. August 5th, 1981 was the day President Ronald Reagan fired more than 11,000 air traffic controllers. Demanding more pay and a shorter work week, PATCO, the air traffic controllers union at the time, was embroiled in a vicious labor dispute with the Federal Aviation Administration. When the talks broke down, PATCO threatened to go on strike, ostensibly shutting down airports and causing the cancellation of thousands of flights during one of the busiest travel periods of the year. Such a strike is illegal according to the sometimes controversial Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. The act essentially prohibits any labor strike to cause unfair harm to those not involved in the dispute or to do any damage to any commerce that would negatively affect the general welfare. This is the reason police and emergency room nurses are forbidden to strike. The damage such a strike would cause is believed to outweigh any grievances over unfair pay or hours. Without an acceptable deal, and worse, without the ability to find common ground, on August 3rd, PATCO's members refused to go to work. Given the strike's impact on the country, President Reagan got personally involved, ordering the air traffic controllers back to work. Meanwhile, contingency plans were also put into place, with supervisors, who were not members of the union, a small group of controllers who had chosen not to strike, and military air traffic controllers enlisted to cover the losses. Though not a perfect solution, these temporary workers were able to keep the majority of flights going. The effect of the strikes was not as severe as expected. And so, on August 5th, 1981, President Reagan fired 11,359 air traffic controllers, nearly every controller working for the FAA at the time. And it didn't stop there. Reagan banned every one of the strikers from ever working for the FAA again for the rest of their lives, a ban that remained in effect until President Clinton lifted it in 1993. Many of the air traffic controllers who were fired that day were veterans, which is where they learned the trade, or civil servants who had worked hard to earn their middle-class incomes. Because of the ban and the fact that their skills were hardly transferable to other industries, there's not a huge demand for air traffic controllers outside the FAA, many of them found themselves in poverty. This is not a story about whether Reagan should or should not have fired the air traffic controllers. This is not a story about labor disputes and the right of unions to stand up to management. This is a story of something quite diabolical. This is a story about the long-term repercussions when a leader sets a new tone about what is acceptable or unacceptable behavior inside an organization. In an attempt to alleviate one short-term strain on our country, President Reagan inadvertently created a new, longer-lasting one. By firing all the air traffic controllers, he sent a message to business leaders across the nation. He unwittingly blessed the swift and even aggressive decision to use mass layoffs to guard against a short-term economic disruption. Though I am certain Reagan never intended it as such, some eager CEOs interpreted his actions as permission for them to do the same. There was now a precedence for protecting commerce before protecting people, And so for the first time ever, the social conventions that had restrained many a CEO from doing something that many may have wished they could in the past were instantly gone. With the tacit approval from on high, the practice of laying off people in mass numbers to balance the books started to happen with greater frequency. Layoffs had existed before the 80s, but usually as a last resort and not an early option. We were now entering a time in which even meritocracy mattered less. How hard someone worked or how much they sacrificed or contributed to the company no longer necessarily translated into job stability. Now anyone could be laid off simply to help balance the books for the year. Careers ended to make the numbers work. Protecting the money as economic theory replaced protecting the people. Under such conditions, how can we ever feel safe at work? How can we ever feel committed to the jobs we have if the leaders of our companies aren't committed to us? The very concept of putting a number or a resource before a person flies directly in the face of the protection our anthropology says leaders are supposed to offer. It's like parents putting the care of their car before the care of their child. It can rip apart the very fabric of the family. Such a redefining of the modern leader wreaks the same havoc on relationships in our companies, or even our society, as it does in our families. Starting in earnest in the 1980s, public institutions and industries succumbed to this new economic perspective. The consumer products industry, the food industry, the media, banking, Wall Street, even the Congress of the United States have all, to varying degrees, abandoned the people they exist to serve in favor of more selfish priorities. Those in positions of authority and responsibility more readily allow outside constituents, sometimes unengaged constituents, to influence their decisions and actions. By agreeing to offer a supply to meet the demands of outsiders, these leaders who act like followers may make the profit they expect while harming the people they claim to be serving. Long-term thinking gives way to short-term thinking, and selfish replaces selfless, sometimes even in the name of service. But it's service in name only. This new leadership priority rattles the very foundation upon which trust and cooperation are built. This has nothing to do with restricting a free market economy. This has to do with forgetting that people, living, breathing people, those who will play a greater role in our ability to innovate, make progress, and beat our competition, are now no longer viewed as our most valuable asset as we aim to compete with numbers. If anything, prioritizing performance over people undermines the free market economy. The better the products, services, and experiences a company is able to offer its customers, the more it can drive demand for those products, services, and experiences. And there is no better way to compete in a market economy than by creating more demand and having greater control over the supply, which all boils down to the will of those who work for us. Better products, services, and experiences are usually the result of the employees who invented, innovated, or supplied them. As soon as people are put second on the priority list, differentiation gives way to commoditization. And when that happens, innovation declines and the pressure to compete on things like price and other short-term strategies goes up. In fact, the more financial analysts who cover a company, the less innovative the company. According to a 2013 study that appeared in the Journal of Financial Economics, companies covered by a larger number of analysts file fewer patents than companies covered by fewer analysts, and the patents that those companies do generate tend to have lower impact. The evidence supports the idea that analysts exert too much pressure on managers to meet short-term goals, impeding firms' investment in long-term innovative projects. Put simply, the more pressure the leaders of a public company feel to meet the expectations of an outside constituency, the more likely they are to reduce their capacity for better products and services. When leaders eat first. Since the boomers took over the running of business and government, we have experienced three significant stock market crashes. One in 1987 that corrected for a period of excessive speculation and some argue an over-reliance on computer programs to make trades instead of people. One in 2000 after the burst of the dot-com bubble. And one in 2008 that followed the collapse of the overvalued housing market. Before 1987, there hadn't been a stock market crash since the Great Depression, which itself followed the excess and overvaluations of the 1920s. If we do not find ways to correct the imbalance ourselves, the laws of nature will always balance it for us. for a species born in a time when resources were limited and dangers were great, our natural inclination to share and cooperate is complicated when resources are plenty and outside dangers are few. When we have less, we tend to be more open to sharing what we have. A Bedouin tribe or a nomadic Mongolian family doesn't have much, yet they are happy to share because it is in their interest to do so. If you happen upon them in your travels, they will open up their homes and give you their food and hospitality. It's not just because they're nice people. It's because their survival depends on sharing, for they know that they may be the travelers in need of food or shelter another day. Ironically, the more we have, the bigger our fences, the more sophisticated our security to keep people away, and the less we want to share. Our desire for more, combined with our reduced physical interaction with the common folk, starts to create a disconnection or blindness to reality. Unfortunately, too many of the environments in which we work today do more to frustrate than to foster our natural inclinations to trust and cooperate. A new set of values and norms has been established for our businesses and our society. A system of dopamine-driven performance that rewards us for individual achievement at the expense of the balancing effects of serotonin and oxytocin, that reward us for working together and building bonds of trust and loyalty. It is this imbalance that causes stock markets to crash. It is this imbalance in corporate cultures that affects the stability of large organizations. Enron, Tyco, WorldCom, and Lehman Brothers are just a few examples of large, quote-unquote, stable organizations that collapsed because of imbalances in their cultures. The seeming lack of effort to want to change the system only creates greater imbalance of the chemicals. And so the vicious cycle continues. Our health is at risk, our economy is at risk, the stability of our companies is at risk, and who knows what else. The big boomer generation has, by accident, created a world quite out of balance. An imbalance, as history has proven over and over, will correct itself suddenly and aggressively unless we are smart enough to correct it ourselves slowly and methodically. Given our inclinations for instant gratification and the weak circles of safety in our organizations, however, our leaders may not have the confidence or patience to do what needs to be done. Obviously, we can't simply blame an entire generation for the ills we face today, nor can we blame an industry or particular CEO or the corporations. There aren't any comic book style archenemies running companies trying to take over the world, who we can simply set our sights on overthrowing to right all that is wrong. But there is a lack of empathy and humanity in the way we do business today. There are smart executives running companies and managing systems, but there seems to be a distinct lack of strong leaders to lead the people. As Bob Chapman, CEO of Barry Waymiller, is fond of saying, "No one wakes up in the morning to go to work with the hope that someone will manage us. We wake up in the morning and go to work with the hope that someone will lead us." The problem is, for us to be led, there must be leaders we want to follow. Dehumanization. Our internal wiring, though complicated and messy in practice, is pretty straightforward in intention. Designed during a time when we lived in small groups with limited resources and great dangers around us, our chemical incentive system was built to help us manage and thrive in what was a very tangible world. We knew all the people with whom we lived and worked. We saw the things we needed, and we worked together to get them. We saw the things that threatened us, and we worked together to protect each other from them. The problem now is we have produced an abundance of nearly everything we need or want, and we don't do well with abundance. It can short-circuit our systems and actually do damage to us and our organizations. Abundance can be destructive, not because it is bad for us per se. Abundance can be destructive because it abstracts the value of things. The more we have, the less we seem to value what we've got. And if the abstraction of stuff makes us value it less, imagine what it does to our relationships. The scale at which we're able to operate today is sometimes too big for us to wrap our heads around. By its very nature, scale creates distance, and at distance, human concepts start losing their meaning. A consumer is just that, an abstraction of a person we hope will consume whatever we have to offer. We try to guess what this consumer wants so that they will consume more of what we have. And if they do, we will keep track of lots of metrics so that we may better manage the process. And as our processes, metrics, and scale continue to grow, we employ technology to help us operate at greater speed and scale. In other words, the human beings, the end users of all this, become so far removed from the people who mean to serve them that they simply become just another metric to be managed. The more distance there is between, or the more things we do that amplify the abstraction, the harder it becomes to see each other as human. It's not the abundance we need to manage or restrict, it's the abstraction. We no longer see each other as people. We are now customers, shareholders, employees, avatars, online profiles, screen names, email addresses, and expenses to be tracked. The human being really has gone virtual. Now, more than ever, we are trying to work and live, be productive and happy, in a world in which we are strangers to those around us. The problem is, abstraction can be more than bad for our economy. It can be quite deadly.